Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only.
Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with your host, Pete Talbot, along with Dr. Samara Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. Now, here's your host of Leading Edge Medicine, Pete Talbot.
Good morning. Good morning. Another Saturday is here. I've got Dr. Mixon. I've got Dr. Umat. And I think just to stay the course, normally, we're going to still at least talk a little bit about COVID, or I should say you are. I'm not going to talk about it. But go ahead. What's the very I understand some people are concerned about these new mutations.
Yes. Well, yeah, I was driving in and I heard some talk show guy, and guy was complaining that, you know, there's 5 and 6 mutations and we just can't keep up with them all. And I had to kind of chuckle to myself as I was driving. The literature actually shows there have been over 4,000 mutations of COVID documented thus far. Good grief. This is an RNA virus, and RNA viruses undergo mutation very, very easy. They're not as stable as DNA viruses. And most of those mutations have no clinical significance at all. It's just that the virus changes. You know, when somebody gets infected, there are literally tens of trillions of viruses in their body. And the immune system is attacking those viruses, and it's destroying some, but the immune system can't kill them all. So it starts selecting the ones that are most resistant to this individual's immune system. And then that person sneezes and the next person gets infected, and the next several trillion viruses, again, a different person's immune system is attacking those survivors and further selecting them for those that will survive from the second person. And then those go to the next person. And so what we're getting is, not only does the virus impact us, the people are impacting the virus. Mm-hmm. And every single individual that gets infected is helping to select different components for that virus depending on that individual. When you got millions of people that have been infected, and each of those people are impacting trillions of viral particles.
Right.
You keep using the word trillions of viral particles.
Yes.
Truly.
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 Yes.
Wow.
Hard to imagine, right?
Yeah, it really is.
Yes. I mean, the numbers involved in viral infections are just mind-boggling. But again, most of those particles don't do diddly squat.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you run this virus through millions of people, the impact on the virus is enormous. And so we put selective change, basically, as though this was evolution. We are doing evolutionary pressures on the virus every time a person gets infected and their immune system interacts with that virus. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we are causing the virus to evolve.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once in a while, a viral mutation happens to be one that has a big impact on its ability to survive and escape the immune system. The reason we think the South African variant is as bad for us as it is that South Africa, like China, has enormous numbers of coronaviruses in that hot, tropical, jungly sort of area. And the people have had many, many coronavirus infections in their ordinary lives. And so this virus, when it hits South Africa or hits the African continent, is infecting people that already have resistance to a lot of coronaviruses. They're able to attack it. So the ones that survive are the ones that have mutated so that they don't resemble the previous coronaviruses. The downside for us human beings is that we have actually now selected in Africa a form of the coronavirus that is resistant to the immune response that is triggered by some of our vaccines.
That's right. Yeah.
And this is now a virus that can actually reinfect people that have had previous coronavirus infections.
Okay.
And so, you know, the question was, if you've had coronavirus, can you get it again? And the early answer was probably not, maybe one person out of a million. But now we've got a virus that has been selected in an environment that has had a lot of coronaviruses in the past.
Right.
And there is a distinct possibility that we will see a higher incidence of people who were infected by this original version of the novel virus that will now also get infected by the African version.
Hmm.
And that's also true of those of us who have had our vaccines. We may well, some yes. of us will be susceptible to the new version of
right.
the virus, which is why Moderna is working so darn hard
right.
to get a booster
correct.
Aimed specifically at that African
right.
variant.
Exactly.
But because this has only been in human beings about a year, this process is going to continue.
Yeah.
And we are going to see several others come out. And that's why when you know, last week's show, I was saying we may be in for 2 or 3 years of this simply because we may be getting different versions of the virus that can hit some of our immunized people and even some of our people that have been infected.
I mean, right. I mean, we're trying to figure it out, but it's trying to figure us out, too.
we are in the process of adapting to
right.
each other.
Yeah. You know? It's not symbiotic yet.
No. 50 years from now, this may be a common cold for
right.
us. But right now, it's a nasty thing, and we are still adjusting.
So how are the vaccines going? I know that is sort of a moving target. But
It is. Well, you know, they're putting the best spin on it they can. Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are still pretty darn effective against the African variant. It's looking like almost 90%. So not as good as they were against the original one they were developed for, but pretty darn good. You know? The AstraZeneca version, the one-shot one that is you know was developed for Europe, not so much. Its effectiveness on the African virus is really crummy.
What is its effectiveness on what we're dealing with now?
Well, the current one, it's up around 80%.
Okay.
The African variant, it could be as low as 35%.
Okay.
But what they're saying, the positive spin they're putting on it is that even if you get the AstraZeneca vaccine, you will not spread the virus as effectively. So even if you get infected, you won't get as sick. And you won't spread it to other people as effectively. So it's still worthwhile using the AstraZeneca vaccine on people because as a population, it will decrease the spread.
Hmm.
I'd still rather have Moderna and Pfizer.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But, you know, it's in short supply. And yes, it's in short supply here, but globally,
it's in short supply. Yes, it is. Yeah. And, you know, and again, Europe made its classic mistake. And that, you know, they were trying to beat the price down because they have, you know, government-controlled medical care systems and they didn't want to pay full price.
Right.
And as a consequence, they didn't come to terms with the pharmaceutical companies until several months after we did. And so their supply is several months behind ours.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, they are where we were back in November when it comes to the really good vaccines.
Right.
So, yeah.
So England is a little further ahead than the rest of Europe?
England's ahead of us.
Oh. Yeah, they started their immunization before we did.
Yeah, they approved it early, and they jumped on it right away. And they started out by saying, hey, we're only going to give one dose to everybody to start with.
Okay.
We're going to give everybody one dose, and then we'll go back and get the second doses. So they're up over 15%, close to 16% vaccination now. We're about 9.5 to 10%, and Europe is down almost 3%.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. All because they were just too cheap.
Cheap.
To, Tucci?
Well, they had a low medical budget. You know, the reason that European hospitals like Italy and Spain and France got overwhelmed, you had to realize that those socialized systems have fewer than half as many intensive care beds as we have.
That's right. They don't. Yeah.
So for per population, they have a lot fewer hospital beds than we've got because they don't want to pay for more. And so if you got less than half as many ICU beds and you get a bunch of ICU patients, they got overwhelmed a lot faster and easier than we do. It was just because our expensive system had a lot more ICUs available.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So you are not predicting additional shutdowns and horrible things to come.
No,
you're just saying
I'm worried about it.
Just start thinking, yeah, maybe.
It is certainly within the realm of possibility. And if Mr. Biden does what he has said he was going to do, which is to put his regulatory state back in place and, you know, and get rid of all of the orders that Mr. Trump put, yeah, well, then we'll, instead of looking at 7-8 months to get a booster, we'll be looking at 2 or 3 years. Now, my hope is he's not that self-destructive. My hope is he's going to say, okay, even if Trump did it, let's keep doing it.
Well, he hasn't in about 20, hasn't, 20 he, other categories.
He hasn't with anything else, but I'm hoping that with this one, you know, the CDC doctors will say, please, Mr. Biden, don't be stupid.
Yeah.
And hopefully he'll listen. But who knows what a politician will do? I have no idea.
Well, I know we get lots of questions at Longevity. We had some very good news that you reported last week that only 1% of our patients have gotten COVID.
Whereas nationally it's 2%, yes. And that the only two patients we know of who got hospitalized at all recovered fully and quickly.
That's right.
And nobody died. So, yes, our people are doing far better than the national average, especially when you take into account the fact that our patients tend to be older people.
That's
so
right.
So they're the highest risk population, and yet our people are doing exceedingly well.
So bottom line, it sounds like we're doing 50% better, but when you consider the age of all of our of our clients,
that we
it's dramatic.
We're a multiple of that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my golly, that is very encouraging. I guess that's one reason why longevity is growing and continuing to grow right through the pandemic, because people are starting to realize it's now not just a good idea, it may be critical.
It may save your life, yeah. It's fascinating. You know, we always said that we treat the normal but undesired changes of aging, but it turns out that in the age of COVID, a normal but undesired age could be dying of COVID. So,
So the whole concept of prevention takes on serious meaning right now.
Yes, it does.
It does, yeah.
Hey, do you know what the richest county in America is?
Well,
I used to think it
has changed over the years.
I used to think it was like, you know, down here in King County with Medina or Beverly Hills.
Used
you know,
to be Montecito, like California, in the hills of Santa Barbara.
Teton.
What?
Teton County. It's
kidding.
Yeah, Jackson Hole.
Well, the millionaires and billionaires go to live.
Are all flooding
vacation
over there to get away from the
coronavirus.
The
yeah.
And so that has raised the income there. And the little hospital, they've only got one little hospital there.
Yeah.
And they're saying they're not overwhelmed at all because, A, people rich enough to fly in there for their summer tend to be younger and healthier and lean because, you know, poor people are the fattest people in America, and that's the biggest single risk factor for COVID.
Yeah.
And so rich people tend to be leaner, and it's a ski area. So people that are flocking in there are skiers and physically active. And interestingly enough, when they fly in with their private jets, the doctor that was interviewed was saying, yeah, and they sometimes bring a private ventilator with them just in case.
That's something.
So you get on your private jet with your ventilator and go off to a mountain ski resort.
That's hilarious.
Jackson Hole.
Who'd have thunk?
Who would have thought?
Well, I guess it makes sense.
It does.
Fly with your ventilator makes sense.
Well, once they tell you, you know. But It's certainly nothing that I had come up with before I, you know,
no
I heard
way,
the interview.
Yeah.
Well, folks, listen, if this is as interesting to you as it is to us, this is an awfully good time for me to remind you, yes, it's a good time to grab one of our free health analysis appointments.
And you won't even need your own ventilator.
That's right. We don't guarantee you won't need your own ventilator. But
nobody has yet.
Nobody has yet. So that,
well,
yeah,
they
that's
have
right.
one, that's fine.
That's right. So here we go. Our free health analysis appointments are easy to get. You go online at lmclinic.com. That's our homepage, lmclinic.com. Push the schedule now button, and it is bing, bang, bong, easy, easy to do. You can also call 866-86-YOUNG to make one of those as well. And yes, we are still giving away $100 of longevity supplements just for coming in for the free appointment with the two free tests. It's the best word in America, I guess, free. But it's one way for you to get the information you need so that you can make an intelligent decision about your health.
When you use that word free,
yes,
it reminds me of something you told me way back in 1998.
Oh, come on. What was that?
You knew he wouldn't forget, right?
The two most important words in advertising are free and all you can eat.
And America has proven that. Okay. Go to lmclinic.com. Make your free health analysis appointment. Hey, time for a break. We'll be right back.
I finally went and took that free test, and it didn't hurt. I went ahead and moved forward with genetic testing and inflammatory markers and stuff like that, so I'm encouraged to see what those results are. So how would this work for my father at 80 years old?
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Pete Talbot here. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine. And, you know, I'm looking at Dr. Umat and Dr. Mixon. We are asked that question about older patients. Would my dad at 80, would my mom at 84, would my uncle at 91, are they too old to be patients at longevity? Well, happy to say no. Definitely happy to say no. We can talk more about that later. But for now, why don't we take a call? And indeed, yes, it is time for another call. So where are we going here? Let's look. Hey, we've got Jack. Jack, welcome to the show.
Hello, Jack. Thank you.
All right, this is Dr. Mixon. And
hi, Jack.
There's you, man.
There you go.
How can we help, sir?
Nice talking to y'all. First of all, I've been a happy customer for going on 3 years now.
A customer? You mean a patient?
That's exactly what I mean, yes.
Oh, okay.
It's been great. It's pretty much life-changing in terms of energy, in terms of losing the brain fog and all that. So I'm very appreciative. Patient.
Super.
Here's my question.
We're glad to hear it.
Thank you. I've heard you say several times on the show over the past few years that you don't recommend the testosterone injections. Mm-hmm. I was on the creams for, I guess, 2.5 years, and we never could get it high enough. We got it kind of in the mid-yellow range, and I've got the numbers here. I don't know which ones to tell you. But we could never get it quite in the green range, so we went to the injections. So mm-hmm. I've been on the injections for, 3-4 months. And immediately it popped it in. Actually, popped it over the green.
Sure.
So now we're backing it off a little bit and trying to still get it in the right range. But mainly I want to reconcile, you know, what I've heard you guys say with about not doing injections with doing the injections. And I want to make sure I'm not doing any. And then I have a follow-up about that as well.
All right. Yeah, my preference is to use the transdermal creams whenever I can. And the vast majority of people do very well on them. But, you know, the vast majority is not everybody. Mm-hmm. And there are people that we just, for some reason, cannot get enough absorption of the drug to give us the results that we need.
I'm real curious. What percentage of our patients the creams don't work on?
You know,
about 1% or so.
Yeah, 1% really? Or less. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jack, you are very special, Jack.
That's right, a special person. Yeah. Yeah, it's rare. You know, I mean, I will have one of my docs say maybe once a year that they've got somebody that for some reason just won't go. So, you know, it happens. Usually we try a lot of different things.
Yes,
you
know? We do.
Usually we try, you know, different concentrations, different bases. Mm-hmm. We will add some DMSO to it to see if that will help drive it through the skin. We will often use it genitally, you know, put it on your penis and scrotum and in the axilla, in the armpits. They're very mm-hmm. thin areas. Mm-hmm. And those areas almost always will kick the levels as high as you want. In fact, we often have to pull them down when we go those places. But like I said, once in a while, the docs will say, hey, I've just tried everything with this guy and it won't come up, and say, fine, then go to the shots. I consider the shots to be second best for several reasons. Depending on whether you're taking a small dose twice a week or a little larger dose once a week or a big dose every other week.
I'm doing once a week.
Okay. And so once a week is okay. Your levels don't go as high. They come down through the normal range okay, and they don't drop as low as every other week would be. So your roller coaster is not as big.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But almost every guy that is on injections for long term ends up with significant testicular atrophy. The testicles get small and soft. Sperm counts, of course, drop out to zip. If you're not trying to father children, that's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some guys have a real emotional thing to testicular size. You know, the mm-hmm. thing is, I was born with a pair, I want to die with a pair sort of thing.
That's about right for me.
That's true, yeah.
You know, and so it's a real emotional hit for some guys when they get some testicular atrophy. Other guys say, eh, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
So it's the old off thing. If you don't mind, it don't matter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you decided you wanted to father another child, long-term injections make it harder to wake up your testicles and get your sperm count back. But again, most guys, once they're over their mid-50s to 60s, really further childbearing is low, low on their list of things to do.
Yeah, and that is my case as well.
Yeah, the one hit we often get is libido. Most men get the best libido, the best sexual desire, if their testosterone rises and falls on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's that filling the testosterone receptor and then the emptying of the receptor and then filling it again that triggers the drive for sex.
Mm-hmm.
Young men peak their testosterone twice a day. They get the high level at sunup, and then another peak at sundown. And then our levels tend to drop during the day so men can work with each other and not kill one another. It kind of, you know, works out better that way. But that's why young men wake up in the morning with their morning testosterone peak urgently wanting sex. You know, you wake up with an erection and you're just desperate. I got to have a woman. That drive drops some during the day. And then in the evening, if you recall your youth, about the time dinner was over and your wife was trying to do the dishes, you were standing behind her groping, wanting sex. That was your evening peak. All right.
Gotcha.
Now, as we age, those peaks diminish and diminish and diminish, and eventually libido kind of slowly fades away and becomes a thing of the past. If we can kick your testosterone up as close to rising and falling, at least daily, we mm-hmm. tend to do a better job of recreating your youthful libido.
Mm-hmm.
We lose that capacity with the injections. So if your libido is staying good and your sexual function is staying good and you don't mind the testicular atrophy, then to heck with it. You know, do what you're doing if it's working.
Yeah, I mean, there's a convenience factor with the injections that's not undeniable, right?
Absolutely.
You don't have to mess with the creams daily. You don't have to wash off. And for travel also, it's very easy. You've got a weekend trip coming up. You don't have to worry about it.
That's right.
But we can't mimic normal physiology with the injections. And in my experience, the injections become old after a while.
Yeah.
Patients say, you know, I'm tired
of needles.
Yes. Eventually, they all want to switch out and do the creams.
So, you know, what I'd say is, if we have actually tried everything we know how to try, you know, but what you might do is chat with your doc, have them present your case on the Tuesday rounds. Every Tuesday at lunch, all the docs get together on the computers with their phone, so that we can see the medical records and the physicians can present difficult cases. And then everybody gets to kibitz to try and figure out to solve the problem. So, you know, if you're happy with the injections, go with it. If you think that maybe libido problems and so on, you want to get to enhance that some, then maybe we should try and figure out what else we can do to try and get you to get the rise and fall in a more natural way.
Gotcha. I'm still trying to figure it out, actually. I'm still trying to figure out the cycle, but it's always seems like it takes me a while to kind of figure out where I am, how I feel with everything.
But you know, with where you are, you're probably getting a peak in the day or two after your injection. And so
that seems about right.
Yeah. And with most older men, especially with wives of a similar age, you know, one or two days a week of sex is more than most of the wives want anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not necessary to go to a daily sort of routine.
Okay. That's great information. I appreciate it. I have noticed, I think, a little bit of the shrinkage you're talking about. I've got a buddy with the exact same profile as me, let's say, and he's got some leftover testosterone cream. So what he's been doing, my buddy, that is, he, you know, so at the end of 7 days, he'll use cream for a couple of days, and then he'll go back to the seven day inject. And then, so instead of every 7 days, it's every 9 days using cream at the end of those 2 days. And that seems to have helped his, it seems like it's helped. It's preventing a little bit of shrinkage. What's your thought on that? Is that a okay practice, just experimental, or what do you think about that?
I don't, you know, even with the creams, some guys need to skip the testosterone 1 or 2 days a week to maintain testicular size.
Yes.
You know, I've been on these creams. Well, no, I started the injections very first when I started this way 23 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I switched over to the creams because I saw a better physiologic effect that way. But, every 2 or 3 years, I'll notice enough atrophy that I, you know, call up Samara and say, I need some HCG, you know, and she writes me a prescription for some human chorionic gonadotropin, and I use that for a month or so and kick all my size back up, and then wait until I notice it again every 2 or 3 years, and then I use a month or two of the HCG.
So, and I think my doctor mentioned that too. Okay.
Yeah, the testicular atrophy can be fixed. It's not irreversible. You know, it's one of those things that if it bugs you, we fix it.
And also, we can just use the HCG and the creams together to get you to physiological levels without testosterone injections, because that, you know, stimulates your own endogenous progesterone as well.
That's right.
That's how it prevents testicular atrophy.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, okay. Well, that's great information.
Okay.
It is great, and it was very nice of you to call in, Jack. Thank you so much. Good call, good questions.
Thank you guys so much.
Take care, Jack.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
Jack.
Again.
Bye-bye.
Dave, we've got more calls coming, more good teaching, more good education. That's what Leading Edge Medicine is all about. After all, it's sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinic. So don't go far. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back before you know it.
I think it's a wonderful thing. It teaches at the seminar and not reacting after the problems. It's trying to prevent the problems from happening in the first place. And the thing I like the most about everything that I've learned is it all makes very logical and intuitive sense.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Papaya, papaya.
And make believe it came from you.
Papaya, papaya.
Not you, Jerry.
I'm gonna write words so, so sweet. They're gonna knock me off
you know,
my feet.
I have still got a lot of the first love letter the Bandy never sent me.
Oh, for crying out loud. I think you mentioned that a while.
I enjoyed it so much. I scanned it. And it, so I pulled it up on my iPad, my cell phone, my office computer, and just reread it from time to time.
Isn't that great? And you didn't write it yourself?
No, it's really from
Bandy. Okay.
She was actually, she wrote this, according to the letter, she was sitting out on her balcony in Sweden, where she was living with a girl from Estonia, a couple of Swedish immigrants. She wrote me this very,
fantastic,
very little sweet two-page letter. I'm so touched. I've kept it.
You've kept it. Well, smart, smart.
50 How long ago was that now?
17 years ago.
That's right. So let me ask you a question. You were talking during the break,
yes,
about the relationship between muscle and fat.
Yes.
And you have some things you'd like to share.
Muscle good, fat bad.
Yes. Yes. don't look at me when you say
move
fat.
On now. No. Yeah. You've seen the pictures of those, you know, muscle bound hormonal monsters, you know, with the muscles on their muscles.
That's not good
everywhere.
Either.
No, that's not good. That's not good. Do you know how many calories a day they need to eat? Just to maintain their muscle mass?
Several thousand.
10 to 12,000 calories a day.
Wow. Oh,
come on.
Yeah.
How do they do
and that? And they have a body fat of 7 or 8%.
Interesting.
They have no body fat, and they're eating 10 to 12,000 calories a day just to keep those muscles from shrinking. Muscle is an incredibly energy-intensive tissue.
Yeah.
Just by existing, it's burning calories like a furnace, even when you sleep. Okay. So that relationship between muscle and fat is extremely important. Okay. Muscle takes 1/4 as much space per ounce as fat does.
Interesting.
So muscle is dense.
Right.
It doesn't take up much space. Fat is fluffy.
Yeah. Soft.
Soft. It takes a lot more space, and it doesn't burn many calories.
Right. It doesn't.
At least the white fat that most of us have.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, brown fat is different. Brown fat actually burns energy.
What is brown fat?
That's a whole different... We'll get to brown fat here in a minute.
Okay.
But most of us have what's called white fat, although it's actually kind of yellow. But it's important if you want to get lean, to get muscular, to make muscle. The problem is that most older people have major declines in their anabolic hormones, the hormones that allow them to make lean tissue. Dehydroepiandrosterone, growth hormone, testosterone, all of these things are falling. And as a consequence, the metabolism is being shifted towards fat and away from muscle.
That's right.
And so even when they exercise, they may tune the muscle they've got up so that it's more resilient, but they don't make much muscle because they don't have the tools that their body needs to make muscle. So the anabolic hormone load is critical.
Right.
And so if you can't make a lot of muscle, then you burn fewer and fewer calories.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've got to really starve yourself to get there. So that's a big problem. One of the things we do at the clinic is we try to raise those anabolic hormone load levels.
Right.
We don't raise them to the bodybuilder levels. I mean, you're not supposed to be up there. It's not good for you. But we try to get them up closer to where you were when you were a younger person and able to maintain your body fat at more acceptable levels.
That's right. Yeah. And remember, Jerry, we always say that we always used to think in the past that fat is innocuous. Well, you know, fine, yes, you're fat, but it's not harmful. But we know differently now.
Yes, we know.
Right. Yeah. We know that fatty tissue is actually a pro-inflammatory agent.
Yes.
And it is not only a risk factor for many diseases, it is actually a propensity for many diseases.
Being overweight increases your risk of, well, for one thing, a 600% increase in risk of dying from COVID.
For sure.
Increased risk of cancers, heart disease, dementia, mm-hmm. osteoarthritis, mm-hmm. and autoimmune diseases.
Right.
Other than that, it's, you know, perfectly yeah. obvious. So, yeah. So, but what we end up doing with our patients is we will often, we bring them in, we measure all their hormone levels, we move their anabolic hormone levels mm-hmm. up to a range where they were when they were younger. Now, that in and of itself doesn't do a whole lot, but what it does do is provides their body with the tools.
Right.
Then if they will get on an exercise program, they can now make muscle.
That's right.
The muscle will actually increase their weight because a square inch of muscle weighs four times as much as a square inch of fat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
a lot denser.
It will. Yes.
But they get leaner.
That's right.
And that muscle makes them stronger. And being stronger, they don't fatigue as easy.
Right.
And if they're not tired, they can do more activity. And
sure.
that in turn helps them to make more muscle.
Absolutely right. And you know, there's when I look at this, sometimes the BMI is not accurate when patients are building more muscle. So if you are big because of muscle mass, you will still have a high BMI that'll put you in the overweight or obese category,
yes.
but it's not because of fat. If you look at your in-body, your fat is actually quite low.
Yes.
It's muscle.
I run about 15% fat, but my BMI says I'm overweight.
Right.
Because I've got about 25% more muscle than I'm supposed to have at my age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for crying.
And see, people don't understand that difference. And so I've had patients say that they'll go to their doctor and their doctor will say, well, you need to lose weight. And, well, that's not true. That's just not true.
I don't want to lose weight.
Right.
I like being strong
yes.
and hard. You know, if I were of, quote, a normal weight, and as fluffy as they would want me to be, my wife would not be happy with me.
Well, you wouldn't be happy with yourself either.
No.
But people don't know the difference, is what I was saying.
Yes,
you know, there's a huge difference.
Important.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we are pushing them towards making some more muscle. The muscle then gives them the energy to be more active, to burn more calories, to make more muscle, to decrease their body fat.
Right.
You put that together with dietary changes.
Yes.
And activity changes, and you've got a winning combination.
You do. And contrary to that, when people go on a calorie-restricted diet, they may lose the weight, but unfortunately, they lose more muscle than fat.
Yes.
And therein lies a big problem, because once they're off their diet, their metabolism has slowed down even more, so they will not only regain the weight they've lost, they'll actually add some more.
Yes.
Because they can't burn it anymore as efficiently as they were doing even before.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
See? And then on the next segment, I'll tell you something about brown fat.
Okay. Okay, I'll tell you what. Let's take another call, and we'll talk about brown fat after the next break. Where are we going here? Let's talk to Bonnie. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for taking my call.
Bonnie, is there a Clyde in your life?
Yes, and people ask me that all the time.
Oh, my goodness.
I actually was getting gas on the way home from San Diego in Sacramento area.
Uh-huh.
I pulled into a gas station, and this gentleman next to me says, oh, what's your name? And I said, my name is Bonnie. He says, I don't believe it. My name is Clyde.
That's great.
That is great.
Yeah.
Are you seeing him now?
Well, actually, he came
and
up
does
with
your husband know?
No. He came up with his father to visit Seattle area, and they took me out to dinner.
That's
nice.
Sweet. That is very nice.
Yeah.
So how can we help you today?
Okay, well, I wanted to ask because I got my first shingles shot last month, and they said to wait up to 2 months and then get the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the 1st of February in a couple weeks. So in the meantime, the corona shot comes along, and I don't know that I should mix them or get have them close together at all. And I want to know your opinion.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I mean, they do ask if you had a recent immunization.
Uh-huh.
In fact, they asked me specifically about shingles.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So my guesstimate is if they're asking, there must be some timing issue.
But yeah. I said yes, but they didn't ask how long ago.
Yeah.
They just wanted to know.
But they gave you the shot anyway.
Yeah, without asking if it was yesterday, for example. You know, okay. So, anyway.
Well, I think I'm going to take it upon myself to space that out like a month.
Yeah. Waiting on the shingles will not decrease its effectiveness. You can wait on that shingles.
I don't want to wait on the shingles. I had it, and I don't want to get it again.
All right.
Okay. But instead of just waiting, why don't you give them a call and ask them? You might not have to wait.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And who am I asking, though?
And so when you call the clinics where you're thinking of getting the immunization, where are you thinking of going for it?
Oh, probably up to here to Swedish in Edmonds.
Perfect. So when you call Swedish and Edmonds, just ask them, is there a conflict with a shingles shot and should you time it to avoid the shingles shot? And if so, by how long? They'll let you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I thought maybe you could answer that, but that's fine. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
No,
well,
I'll let you know.
I'll let you know.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that. Okay.
Call back in.
One other quick question is my partner, every once in a while, has the night sweat. And I'm wondering if somehow he's losing whatever estrogen he has, or for men, is it a different symptom or
that's
a
reason? Yeah, that's an excellent question. With men, yes, men can get menopausal vasomotor instability. we make our estrogen out of our testosterone.
Right.
And if our testosterone level drops too low, then we don't have enough substrate to make estrogen. And then when the estradiol level drops too low in the brain, we can indeed start getting hot flashes and mood swings and so on, and even develop osteoporosis.
Yeah.
So it is possible. On the other hand, thyroid dysfunction can cause night sweats at night.
Okay.
So when I see a guy who is having night sweats, several things I want to look at. Is his thyroid okay? Is his testosterone okay? Is his estradiol okay? Those are the big three hormonal bugaboos. But then if those three are okay, then I start saying, does he have an occult cancer hiding somewhere?
Okay.
Because there are malignancies that can trigger night sweats as a consequence of the cancer. They basically rev the metabolism because the tumors are growing rapidly and there's a big metabolic stress as a result of that.
Okay.
So that's also, a possibility. That's one we certainly don't like, and it's much harder to fix than the others.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
Okay.
And then a couple of other things are about his sugar. If he's hypoglycemic or diabetic, that could also, if he's, getting worse, then that could also precipitate. So, and infections.
Infections are a biggie,
and
especially prostate bladder infections
in
men. So
those
are fairly common, especially men that are getting partial obstruction. They're having to get up and pee several times at night. Then they can end up with prostatic and bladder infections that can give night sweats.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess lastly, if he's been started on any new medications.
No. Sure. He's been taking... What is it? Is it statins? I always get these mixed up for
cholesterol?
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Statins are not normally associated with night sweats. They more likely to cause muscle pain or cramping or fatigue.
Achiness.
However, long-term use of high doses of statins will cause diabetes.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. Because he's been taking them for a long time.
Yeah. So he needs to have his insulin curves done. He needs to have his hemoglobin A1C, his fasting and evoked sugars, just to be safe.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm afraid we've kind of given you a long list of male night sweat stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's okay. I have pen and pencil, paper here, so I'm good. One quick question for me is it okay to have, I don't drink much coffee, and they say that with Alzheimer's, if you drink coffee, it's good for the brain.
Coffee lowers your risk of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And lowers your risk of Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
It lowers the risk of almost all neurologic degenerative diseases.
Okay.
Coffee's good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm so grateful that coffee doesn't cause any problems because I chug the thing.
Okay.
Well, I wouldn't say it doesn't cause any problems.
Well, not serious problems like cancer and dementia.
Oh, no. But it does explain your hypermanic sort of behavior.
Well, that I dance all the time. Still not a problem.
Okay. I have to step in here and regain control.
Okay. So. Well, that's all
Bonnie.
I have to ask. I appreciate it. Thank you so
Bonnie.
Very much.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
Bonnie. Bonnie.
Bye-bye.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it.
Hey, folks. We've got lots still coming up. I did remember, though. I just now remembered. I want to tell you about next Saturday. We've got Dr. Dan Nelson from Pro Ortho. He's going to be here. Special, you know, live in the studio. I've got Dr. Michael Gilbert coming next Saturday as well from Northwest Vision Institute. So get your questions ready. We're going to take a lot of calls for both of those guys. They'll be at two different times. I'll try to let you know before the end of the show. I'm not sure if I can tell you exactly when they'll be here, but they will be here. So that is next Saturday here on Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back.
I've been away for 5 weeks. I've been in Italy, and I got to tell you, I kind of miss you guys on the weekend because you have this rare honesty that you find in Europe, but you don't see in the United States. Everybody's too careful about what they say and don't say, and I just love the fact that you tell it like it is.
Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, this finger pumping time.
Dr. Mixon,
yes,
you definitely tell it like it is, and you can never be accused of hiding the ball. Everybody knows.
Soft pedaling.
Soft pedaling.
Yes.
They know where you are. Now, you told us about white fat, which he actually said is closer to yellow.
Yes.
But you were going to tell us, so we need to know about brown fat. What the heck is that?
It's a different type of fat that actually is a high energy consumer, and it burns sugar. How about that?
Okay.
Who'd have thunk fat?
Well, how do you make brown fat?
You start out by being an infant. Babies have a fair bit of it.
Okay.
Because babies can't shiver.
Babies cannot shiver.
They can't shiver. No, physiologically, an infant cannot shiver to generate heat. You know, when you're really cold and you find yourself shivering, what your body's doing is those muscles are fasciculating, relaxing, contracting at super speed to generate heat so you don't freeze.
Okay.
Babies can't do that. So they come with brown fat built in. So when the temperature drops, the brown fat triggers energy production.
Oh, okay.
How's that for a neat trick? Okay.
So is there a way for adults to develop brown fat?
Yes.
Okay.
And it actually helps burn white fat.
He's pointing his finger at me very, very hard and pointing.
But I don't think you'll like the best way to do it.
Okay.
Which is you need to dress very lightly and spend time in a cold room.
Okay.
Low temperatures trigger the production of brown fat.
So so people who live in Antarctica can more easily develop.
Especially if you sleep in an igloo. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, if you're in and a modern heat with good heat, with a good furnace.
I'm saying if you're out in the cold all the time.
You don't even have to be that cold, actually. Temperatures in the mid 60s will do the job.
Really?
Yes. So even people in our environment, if they are dressing lightly with a short sleeve shirt and, you know, slacks or trousers or something, and their temperature is 65 degrees, and they spend the evenings in that cool environment, they're actually more prone to make some brown fat to help keep their bodies warmer.
And that's a good thing because it burns.
Because it keeps your body warmer by burning the other kind of fat and by burning sugar.
Oh, so it burns the white fat.
It burns sugar and the white fat. So it helps correct your insulin resistance. And it's burning your chubby fat. And the brown fat tends to be located back of your neck and down on either side of your spine. So it's not the belly fat. Brown fat tends to be located differently along your back instead of your front.
You know, in 22 years of doing this program, you've never talked about brown fat before. Isn't that weird? Okay.
But it's an adaptation. Your body thinks that you are now an infant that, you know, is helpless, and you need to adapt to this cold environment, i.e. your 65-degree house. And so you start producing brown fat to help you burn the calories and stay warmer.
See, human physiology is so fascinating.
It really is.
But adapting to the circumstances.
We are wonderful creatures that will change our physiology to adapt to whatever environment we're in.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Well, there you go. Brown fat, folks. You learn it here. All right. Hey, let's take another call.
Let's go to Everett. Talk to Mark. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello, Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
How can we be of help?
Pete, I have a quick question.
Uh-oh.
Who chooses your bumper music?
Well, I'm to blame for that. We made this decision. I made the decision. I sort of surprised Jerry with it here about a year and a half ago. But for the very first time in the 20 years of the show, we are inundated with positive comments. Are you happy or sad about the music?
All I want to say is it's great, and I want to say that during both segments that you do, the earlier segment and this one, you guys have better music on these shows that you do than the music stations.
Oh, see, I agree with you.
But then he picks the music.
We can barely listen to any music stations anymore. So one of the reasons we like to tune in to your shows is for the music. It's fantastic. Right. We love it.
Well, good. Thank
Bloody
you.
Hell. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Appreciate
welcome,
the call.
Sir. Take
thank
care.
You. We all learn something new every Saturday here. On Leading Edge Medicine, brown fat. I had no clue. That's very interesting. With that in mind, let me tell you, we're coming close to the end of our first hour here of Leading Edge Medicine. And we're going to have a break at the top of the hour, station ID and all that sort of good stuff. And then we will be back with hour number two. And there's a lot coming up. I think Dr. Mixon is going to be talking about the behavior, relationships between men and women. I think you're going to find it fascinating, actually. It really is. But lots coming. Collagen and joint pain, all sorts of good stuff that we're going to talk about down the track here. So, as it comes. Here's the break, the top of the hour, and we'll be back before you know it.